Feeding the Flame by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 2. Never reply to criticism. To do so is to weaken your case. The old man was alone at home. Ma, Buttercup, Miss Cleopatra, and Miss Tatalinka were out about the ordinary business which seems to surround all households, out shopping, because even in the best ordered communities there is always the inevitable shopping. Potatoes, soap flakes, various other things, including, well, let us whisper it, unmentionable requisites, without which in modern days we cannot easily manage. And so the old man was lying back in his bed, listening to the radio. Reception was good. The program was coming along on the African service of the BBC, very clearly and with good volume. Someone was playing the new musical hits. The old man smiled at one piece with the unlikely title of Astral Journey. He had to stop his program because the telephone was ringing, the telephone beside his bed. With that disposed of, he switched on again in time to hear one of the latest hits. An announcer of the BBC or disc jockey or whatever he was announced in a decidedly Cockney voice that he was just going to put on the latest record called Without the Night There Would Be No Sunshine. Without the night there would be no sunshine. Did the fellow know that he uttered a great truth there? One has to have extremes in order to have anything. Sometimes, from the USA, particularly on a Sunday, there comes, by way of the short waves, a horrible program sent out by some gang of revivalist missionaries. The uproar, the ranting, is enough to turn anyone against Christianity. And then, from a station in South America, just by the equator, there is another religious revival gang. They fairly hoot about the terrors of not being a Christian. Everyone not a Christian, according to this station, is damned and will go to hell. Surely not the way to conduct a sane religion. Without the night, there can be no sunshine. Without evil, there can be no good. Without Satan, there can be no God. Without cold, there can be no heat. Without extremes, how can there be anything? If there were no extremes, there would be only a static condition. Think of when you breathe, you force out your breath. That is one extreme, because to all practical purposes, you have no breath within you, and you are in danger of suffocating. Then you take in breath, and you have a lot of air in you. And if you take in too much breath too quickly, you are in danger through hyperventilation. But again, if you do not breathe out, and you do not breathe in, then you have nothing. And you can't live. Some remarkably foolish person in Nova Scotia sent me a silly, badly duplicated, purplish effusion about sinners and Satan. Apparently the idea was that I should send them some money, as that would help wipe out Satan. Wipe out Satan? Perhaps they were going to get some of the latest detergents and spread it on a new floor cloth or something, and try to rub out old Satan that way. Anyway, all that garbage went where it should go, in the garbage. There must be negative, or there cannot be positive. There must be opposites, or there is no motion. Everything that exists has motion. Night gives way to day, day gives way to night, summer gives way to winter, and winter gives way to summer, and so on. There just has to be motion. There just have to be extremes. It's not bad to have extremes. It just means that two points are separated from each other as far as they can be. So, good old Satan, keep him going for a time, because without Satan, there could be no God. And without God, there could be no Satan, because there wouldn't be any humans either. The worst Satan is the awful driveler who tries to ram some religion down the throat of a person of another religion. I am a Buddhist, and I definitely resent all the stupid creeps who send me Bibles, New Testaments, Old Testaments, pretty pictures, purely imaginary, of course, or should it be impurely, of crucifixions, etc., etc., ad nauseam. I am a Buddhist. All right, I am an extreme from Christianity, but Christians are extreme from me, as a Buddhist. I do not try to get any converts to Buddhism. In fact, a vast number of people write and ask me if they can become Buddhists, and my invariable answer is that they should remain affiliated with the religion to which they were born, unless there's some great, great overriding condition or circumstance. I do not like people who change their religion just because it's the going thing, or the newest thing, or because they want to thrill and have people point them out and say, "Look, he's a Buddhist." But without the darkness, there can be no sunshine. Yes, Mr. Announcer with the Cockney voice, you certainly said a great truth there. Don't let's persecute old Satan so much. He's got to live. Otherwise, there's no standard of comparison, is there? If there was no talk of Satan, how would you judge good? If there was no bad, there could be no good. Obviously not, because there would be no standard of comparison, because one must be able to compare X with Y. Then we have good and bad, just as in USA and Canada, it seems there have to be good guys and bad guys. The good guys are always the red-blooded He-Man, all-American with Ivy League suits and the Pepsodent smile, whereas the bad guy is automatically the poor Indian who was swindled out of his country with a lot of specious promises. But think of the television program. Wouldn't it be dull if there were no good guys who could fight against the bad guys, or if there were no bad guys who could show how good the good guys really were? So, to all of you people who write in and say, "Don't I think Satan should be bumped off or rubbed out or excommunicated or sent to Russia or something?" Let me say now, no, I think Satan is a good guy in that he provides a fall guy for good. He provides a standard against which we can measure good. So let's drink a toast to Satan, but just for luck, let's have some sulfuric acid and brimstone in a glass and tip it upside down. It's safer that way. The old man groaned as he unfolded the letter. "I wrote to England for a touchstone," he read. 4 weeks it was, and I sent them the money, but I haven't had an answer. I think I'm being swindled." The old man groaned aloud. Then he looked at the envelope and groaned again. First of all, the old man is not in any way connected or interested in any business concern or venture. Sometimes a firm will branch out and claim that it is associated with Lobsang Rampa, etc., etc. There is only one case, and that is with a firm in England. They have permission to use the name of the Rampa Touchstone Company. But again, the old man wants to make it very, very clear that he is not connected with nor interested in any business enterprise. There is one firm with whom the old man is extraordinarily displeased because they advertise a mail order company using the name of the old man's first book entirely without his permission, definitely with his disapproval. So there it is, that's business for you. But the old man groaned as he looked at the envelope, and he groaned because neither on the envelope nor on the letter was there any address. In the USA and Canada, people sometimes put their name and address on the envelope, but rarely on the letter where it should be. In England and Europe, the letter sheet itself bears the name and address of the sender, and so one can always reply to letters from England and Europe, yet this particular person, groaning so bitterly and so libelously about being swindled, had no address to which I could reply. What should one do then? The signature was just Mabel, nothing else, no surname, no address, and the postmark, well, that could not be read even with a magnifying glass. So, you people who complain that you have had no reply, that you are being swindled, ask yourself, did you really put your address on the letter or on the envelope? A little time ago, we had a letter and we couldn't read a single word of it. Probably it was in English, but we just couldn't read any part of it, so it had to go unanswered. The purpose of a letter is to make something known, and if the writing cannot be read, the letter fails in its purpose, and if there's no address on it, well, it's just a waste of time. The old man, listening to his program, the overseas program of the BBC, pondered upon sounds. A few years back, music was a very pleasant thing, a soothing thing or a rousing thing, but now, what has happened to the world? The stuff that's coming from England is like a horde of tomcats with their tails tied together. It isn't music. I don't know what it is, but sounds, well, different sounds, are peculiar to different cultures. People have certain sounds which are alleged to do them good, such as the sound of om, correctly pronounced. Yet there are other sounds which are not socially acceptable. The sounds of certain four-letter words, for example, are not socially acceptable, and yet perhaps those same sounds are absolutely permissible in the language of another culture. There's a certain four-letter sound which is naughty, naughty, very naughty indeed in English, and yet the sound in Russian is perfectly correct, perfectly decent, and used many, many times a day. Do not place too great a reliance on sounds. Many people get almost demented wondering if they are pronouncing om correctly. Of itself, om is nothing. It doesn't mean a thing of itself. Not even if you pronounce it as it should be pronounced in Sanskrit. It is useless to pronounce a metaphysical word of power correctly unless you also think correctly. Consider this. Think of your radio program. You have certain sounds which, of themselves, cannot be transmitted. Those sounds can only be transmitted if, first of all, you have a carrier wave. A carrier wave is similar to the light you have to show before you can transmit a cine picture or a television picture or show your slides on a screen. The slides themselves, without light, are nothing. You have to have a light beam as a carrier, and in precisely the same way, you have to have a carrier wave before you can transmit your radio program. Again, in exactly the same way, the sound of Om, etc., or some other word of power, merely acts as a carrier wave to correct thoughts. Do you want it made clearer? All right. Suppose we made a phonograph record which had nothing but Om correctly pronounced. Om, 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 Om. You could play that record forever and a day, provided it did not wear out first. And you just wouldn't do any good because the phonograph player, or gramophone, if you happen to be in England, is an unthinking machine. Om is useful only when one is thinking correctly as well as sounding correctly. The best way to improve is to get one's thoughts right and let the sound take care of itself. Sounds. What a powerful thing a sound can be. It can add impetus to one's thoughts. Music, good music, can stir one and lift one up spiritually. It can lead one to a greater belief in the honesty of one's fellows. Surely that is a most desirable attainment in itself. But music, specially designed, can make a rabble into a warlike army. Marching songs can help one march correctly and with less effort. But now, what's happened to the world? What's all this stuff? Worse than jazz, worse than rock and roll. What's happened that young people are trying to drive themselves crazier with discordant cacophony, which seems to be designed to bring out all the worst in them, drive them to drug addiction, drive them to perversions, and all the rest of it? That's what's happened, you know. People subjected to the wrong sound can have a longing for drugs. Drinking songs can make people desire to drink more. Some of the old German Biergarten songs were much the same as salted nuts provided, apparently by some bars, to increase the thirst and enable one to drink more to the greater glory of the barkeeper's income. Now there are wars, revolutions, and hatreds and disturbances all over the world. Man fights against man, and things will get much worse before they get much better. Sounds, bad sounds, cause it. Screaming, ranting agitators, rousing the worst thoughts in the rabble, just as Hitler, a most gifted but distorted orator, was able to rouse normally staid, sensible Germans to a frenzy, to an orgy of destruction and savagery. If only we could change the world by eliminating all the discordant music, all the discordant voices who preach hate, hate, hate. If only people would think love and kindness and consideration for others. There is no need for things to go on as they are. It just needs a few determined people of pure thought to produce those necessary sounds in music and in speech, as would enable our poor, sorely stricken world to regain some semblance of sanity instead of all the vandalism and juvenile delinquency which assails us daily. Then, too, there should be some censorship of the press, for the press always, almost without exception, strives to make things appear more sensational, more bloodthirsty, more horrendous than really is the case. Why not all of us have a period of meditation, thinking good thoughts, thinking and also saying good thoughts? It's so easy, because the power of sound controls the thoughts of many people. Sound, provided it has a thought behind it. The old man lay back in his bed. The poor fellow had no choice. Miss Cleopatra was lying on his chest, with her head nestled in his beard, purring contentedly. She gazed up with the bluest of blue eyes. Miss Cleopatra Rampa, the most intelligent of people, the most loving and unselfish of people, just a little animal to most people, although an exceptionally beautiful animal. To the old man, this was a definite, intelligent person, a person who had come to this earth to do a specific task, and who was doing it nobly and with entire success. A person with whom the old man had long telepathic conversations, and he learned much from her. In the electric wheelchair, Miss Tatalinka Rampa was curled up snoring away. Every so often her whiskers would twitch and her eyes would roll beneath her closed eyelids. Taddy was the most affectionate person, and Taddy loved comfort. Comfort and food were Taddy's main preoccupations, and yet Taddy earned her food and her comfort. Taddy, the most telepathic of cats, did her share in keeping touch with various parts of the world. There came a light tap at the door, and friendly neighbor came in and plonked a solid behind with a resounding thwack upon a seat which seemed inadequate to contain such bulk. "Love your cats, don't you, Gov?" said friendly neighbor with a smile. "Love them? Good gracious, yes. I regard them as my children, and as remarkably intelligent children at that. These cats do more for me than humans." By now, Tatalinka was alert, sitting up, ready to growl, ready to attack if necessary, because both little cats can be very, very fierce indeed, in defense of what they regard as their responsibilities. At one apartment, a man had tried to enter at night. Both cats had rushed to the door and nearly scared 10 years of growth onto the poor fellow, because a Siamese cat, in a fury, is quite a frightening sight. They puff out, every hair of their fur stands straight out at right angles to the body. Their tails fluff out, they stand on tiptoe, and they look like something out of the Inferno. They should not be called cats, really, because they are unlike cats. They roar, growl, and fume, and nothing is too dangerous for a Siamese cat protecting a person or property. There are many legends about protecting by Siamese cats, many legends originating in the East about how this or that Siamese cat protected important people or sick people. But enough. No one else tried to enter our apartment without our knowledge. The story of the fierce Rampa cats went the round, and people are more frightened of wild Siamese cats than they are of mad dogs, it seems. So it was, or it should be, now it is, that now, with the old man so disabled, the two little cats are ever alert to rush to his defense. Oh, yes. Among our questions, here's a question from a lady who asks about animals. Where is it now? Oh, here. Can you tell us what happens to our pets when they leave this earth? Are they utterly destroyed, or do they eventually reincarnate as humans? The Bible tells us that only humans go to heaven. What have you got to say about that? Madam, I have a lot to say about it. The Bible was written a long time after the events related happened. The Bible is not the original writings either. It is a translation of a translation of a translation of another translation, which has been retranslated to suit some king or some political power or something else. Think of the King James edition, or this edition, or that edition. A lot of things written in the Bible are bunk. No doubt there was a lot of truth in the original scriptures, but a lot of things in the Bible now are no more truth than the truth of the press, and anyone knows what a lot of bilge that is. The Bible seems to teach humans that they are the lords of creation, that the whole world was made for man. Well, man has made an awful mess of the world, hasn't he? Where are there not wars or rumors of wars? Where is there no sadism, no terror, no persecution? You will have to move off this earth if you want an answer to that. But we are dealing with animals and what happens to them. In the first case, there are many different species of creatures. Humans are animals, whether you like it or not. Humans are animals, horrid, uncouth, unfriendly animals, more savage than any of the nature-type animals. Because humans have a thumb and fingers, they have been able to develop along certain lines because they can use their hands to fabricate, and animals cannot do that. Man lives in a very material world and only believes that which he can grasp between his fingers and his thumb. Animals not having thumbs and not being able to grasp a thing in two hands have had to evolve spiritually, and most animals are spiritual. They do not kill unless for the absolute necessity of eating. And if a cat terrorizes and tortures a mouse, well, that's an illusion of the human. The mouse is quite oblivious of it, because it is hypnotized and feels no pain. Do you like that? Under stress, a person's sensations are numbed. So, in times of war, for example, a man can have an arm shot off, and apart from a very dim numbness, he will not feel it until loss of blood makes him weak. Or a person piloting a plane, for instance, can be shot through the shoulder, but he will go on piloting his plane and bring it down safely, and only when the excitement has ended will he feel pain. In the case of our mouse, by that time the mouse doesn't feel anything anymore. Horses do not reincarnate as daffodils. Marmosets do not reincarnate as maggots, or vice versa. There are different groups of nature people, each one in a separated, isolated shell, which does not impinge upon the spiritual or astral existence of others. What that really means is that a monkey never reincarnates as a man never reincarnates as a mouse. Although, admittedly, many men are mouse-like in their lack of intestinal fortitude, which is a very polite way of explaining, well, you know what. It is a definite statement of fact that no animal reincarnates as a human. I know humans are animals as well, but I am using the commonly accepted term. One refers to a human and one refers to animals because humans like to be buttered up a bit, and so one pretends that they're not animals, but a special form of creature, one of God's chosen humans. So, the human animal never never reincarnates as a canine animal or feline animal or equine animal. And again, our old friend, vice versa. The human animal has one type of evolution which he must follow. Has a different and not necessarily parallel form of evolution to follow, so they are not interchangeable entities. Many Buddhist scriptures refer to humans coming back as spiders or tigers or something else, but of course that is not believed by the educated Buddhist. That started as a misunderstanding many centuries ago, in much the same way as there is a misunderstanding about Father Christmas or about little girls being made of sugar and spice and everything nice. You and I know that all little girls are not nice. Some of them are very nice. Some of them are proper stinkers. But of course, you and I, we only know the nice ones, don't we? When a human dies, the human goes to the astral plane, about which we shall say more later, and when an animal dies, it too goes to an astral plane where it's met by its own kind, where there is perfect understanding, where there is perfect rapport between them. As in the case of humans, animals cannot be bothered by those with whom they are incompatible. And now study this carefully. When a person who loves an animal dies and goes to the astral world, that person can be in contact with the loved animal. They can be together if there is absolute love between them. Further, if humans were more telepathic, if they were more believing, if they would open their minds and receive, then loved animals who had passed over could keep in touch with the humans even before the humans passed over. Let me tell you something. I have a number of little people who have passed over, and I am still very definitely, very much in contact with them. There is one little Siamese cat, Cindy, with whom I'm in daily contact, and Cindy has helped me enormously. On Earth, she had a very bad time indeed. Now she is helping, helping, always helping. She's doing absolutely as much as anyone on the other side can do for anyone on this side. Those who truly love their so-called pets can be sure that when this life has ended for both, then they can come together again. But it's not the same. When humans are on Earth, they are a disbelieving crew, cynical, hard, blasé, and all the rest. When they get to the other side, they get a shake or two, which enables them to realize that they are not the lords of creation they thought they were, but just part of a divine plan. On the other side, they realize that others have rights as well. When they get to the other side, they find that they can talk with utmost clarity to animals who are also on the other side, and animals will answer them in any language they care to use. It is a limitation on humans that most of them, while on Earth, are not telepathic. Most of them, while on Earth, are not aware of the character and the ability and powers of so-called animals. But when they pass over, It all comes clear to them. And humans then are like a person born blind who can suddenly see. Yes, animals go to heaven. Not the Christian heaven, of course, but that's no loss. Animals have a real heaven. No angels with goose feathers for wings. It's a real heaven. And they have a menu, or God, who looks after them. Whatever man can obtain or attain on the other side, so can an animal. Peace, learning, advancement, anything and everything. Upon the earth, man is in the position of being the dominant species, dominant because of the fearful weapons which he has. Unarmed, a man would be no match for a determined dog. Armed with some artificial method, such as a gun, a man can dominate a whole pack of dogs, and it is only through man's viciousness that the telepathic power of communication with animals has been lost. That is the real story of the Tower of Babel, you know. Mankind was telepathic for general use, and mankind used speech only in local dialects for communicating with members of the family when they did not want the community as a whole to know what was being said. But then, man lured animals into traps by false telepathy, by false promises. As a result, mankind lost the telepathic power as a punishment, and now only a few people on this earth are telepathic. And for those of us who are, it is like being a sighted person in the country of the blind. Well, madam, to answer the question in your letter briefly, no, humans do not reincarnate as animals. Animals do not reincarnate as humans. Yes, animals go to heaven, and if you truly love your pet, then you can be together after you pass over, if your love is truly love, and not just selfish, senseless desire to dominate or possess. And finally, on this subject, animals are not an inferior species. Humans can do a vast number of things that animals cannot. Animals can do a vast number of things that humans cannot. They are different, and that's all there is to it. They are different, but not inferior. Now, Miss Cleo, resting so comfortably, looked up with those limpid blue eyes and sent a telepathic message. To work, we have to work, or we do not eat. So saying, she rose gracefully and most delicately walked off. The old man, with a sigh, turned to another letter and another question. Are there mantras for sending dying animals to higher realms? And if so, what are such mantras? One doesn't need mantras from humans to animals. Just as humans have their own helpers waiting on the other side of life to help the dying human to be reborn back into the astral, so animals have their own helpers. And so there are no mantras necessary to help dying animals enter the astral world. Anyhow, animals know, by instinct or by pre-knowledge, far more about such things than do humans. One should not await until an animal is dying before one is ready to help. The best way to help an animal is while it is alive and well on this earth, because animals are beautiful creatures. And there are no bad or vicious animals unless they have been made bad and vicious by the ill treatment, conscious or otherwise, of humans. I have known many cats, and I have never known a cat who was naturally vicious or bad-tempered. If a cat has been tormented by humans, or by human children most likely, then of course it does adopt a protective fierceness. But soon, with little kindness, all that goes, and one has a gentle, devoted animal again. You know, a lot of people are scared stiff about Siamese cats, saying how fierce they are, how destructive, how everything bad. It isn't true. There isn't a word of truth in it, not a word. Miss Cleopatra and Miss Tadalinka never, never do anything to annoy us. If something irritates us, then we just say, "Oh, don't do that, Clee," and she doesn't do it. Our cats do not tear up furniture or draperies because we have a pact with them. We provide a very easily made scratching post. Actually, we have two. These are sturdy posts, strongly mounted on a square base. Both are covered with heavy carpet, not old scruffy carpet on which one has upset the garbage pail, but new carpet, actually cut-offs. Well, this carpeting has been securely fixed to the posts, and on top of the posts there's room for a cat to sit. Several times a day, Cleopatra and Tadalinka go to their scratching posts, and they have such a long, beautiful stretch that it makes one feel better just to watch. Sometimes they'll walk up to the post instead of jumping to the top, and that's very good for their muscles and very good for their claws. So we provide the scratching posts, and they provide the tranquility, because we do not have to fear for any furniture or draperies. Once I thought of writing a book about cat legends and the real story of cats. I'd love to, but increasing decrepitude makes it improbable that I ever shall. I would like to tell, for instance, how, on another world in another system, far removed from the solar system, there was a high civilization of cats. In those days, they could use their thumbs as humans could, but, just as humans are doing now, they fell from grace, and they had a choice of starting around all over again, or going to another system to help a race not yet born. Cats are kind creatures and understanding creatures, and so the whole race of cats and the Manu of cats decided to come to the planet we call Earth. They came to watch humans and to report to other spheres on the behavior of humans. Something like having a television camera watching all the time. But they watch and report not to harm humans, but to help them. In the better regions, people do not report things to cause harm, but only so that defects may be overcome. Cats came to be naturally independent, so they would not be swayed by affection. They came as small creatures, so that humans could treat them kindly or treat them harshly, according to the nature of the humans. Cats are benign, a good influence on Earth. Cats are a direct extension of a great overself of this world, a source of information where much information is distorted by world conditions. Be friendly with cats, treat them kindly, have faith in them, knowing that no cat has ever willingly harmed a human, but very, very many cats have died to help humans. Well, Miss Tadalinka has just rushed in with a telepathic message. "Hey, Gov, guess what? There's 78 letters for you today." 78 letters. It's about time I got down to answering some which are waiting. End of chapter 2.